Hello and welcome to Policy Matters, the podcast from Taito where we explore the intersection between policy and communications and the evolving role of media in shaping global tech policy. This series helps PR and communication leaders at tech companies understand how to engage with the media, build meaningful relationships, and craft stories that drive impact in a complex European and global political landscape.
In this episode, we're joined by Romain Armengaud, Media Relations and Communication Officer at Euroconsumer. This episode was recorded whilst Romain worked as a tech and industry reporter at Euronews. Prior to her role at Euronews, Romain held a number of journalist roles in the policy and tech space, including editor of EU-focused Eyes on Europe and creating content for the newsletter of leading policy and politics outlet, Context.
Romain, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
So, Romain, you're covering some of the tech policies that are shaping, I think it's safe to say, not just the world of tech, but actually the world that we live in at the moment. It's a really interesting, exciting space. But what do you really see as your role? Because, I mean, there's two aspects, aren't there? There's shaping the public understanding of that technology, but you also want to try and avoid the hype cycle of just talking about the latest cool new gadgets.
So I would say that in my work, I wish to avoid, but I could not avoid the hype cycle, because also at the end, Euronews is an ad-based model. So we need the clicks to survive and to generate money. And I think I see more my role of giving clarity of what's going on at the end behind those hypes story. For example, right now there is this hot topic. I don't know if it's the hype, you could call it, but about the problem with big Chinese platform. So we had the problem with Shein and Temu sending this sex doll looking like children, and that authority, French authority, find it and then ask to buy the website at the French level, but also European level. And so here I see my role less as simply explaining, okay, this happened, but more looking at, but what is the legal basis to which the French can actually ban the website if there is one? What are the loophole? What does it say about the European problem with enforcement of their rules? What does it say about the place of Chinese platform in the European economy at the end? So looking at the bigger picture. But I would say also my job is also to make the news and living a bit this circle of news. But what I say make is not make in a way of creating fake news, but of course, but more about looking for voices that haven't been heard, or industry that have concerns that haven't been reported so far, or to discuss just problematic in general that haven't been put on paper. So I would say that's how I see my role.
I was going to say that story probably gave you an opportunity to do both of those things. Yeah. Quite, provide quite an in-depth explainer and also quite good for clicks.
Exactly. But, yeah. And the story is quite a bit like at the end, it's always like, I think it's quite as easy to also trying to find a French new angle to just put a light on this event.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing quite a lot of, and you must be seeing it too, a hugely sophisticated comms effort from businesses at the moment to talk around some of these big emerging technologies. Maybe not in that specific sector, I don't know, maybe. But around, you know, some of the big sort of like hype technologies like AI, for example, you, I'm sure, are bombarded with emails and phone calls from companies trying to sell you on the latest gadget or the latest sort of policy. I mean, how do you filter some of those messages and assess what's relevant to what you're doing, make sure that you stay independent and also stay grounded in ultimately what your role is?
So out of that, I have also a clear plan of what are the topic that I'm covering and what are the topic that I'm interested in. So me, it's really much EU policy, and then with precise topic, I don't know, consumer protection, social media. It's true that I get contacted a lot, I get a lot of, I don't know, press briefing, invite to events, interviews, offers. So I think for me, it's important that when I'm getting contacted, the person know what I'm doing, why they are contacting me, having a first, having somehow a personal email, make it for me more relevant in thinking, okay, do I want to take the 10 seconds to read this email or not? Because sometimes when I see, oh, this is this topic that I don't cover at all. For example, for some reason, I get contacted about anything related to energy when I never covered this topic. Then it goes directly to trash. I think it's important to target when you speak to a journalist. And on my side is just to know what I'm covering and what would be important for my audience.
I mean, that's really interesting points there. And I know we'd love to dig into kind of some of those pitfalls and mistakes that you know, comms teams can make when trying to engage with journalists. But before we do that, as Jack was saying, we're seeing a lot of efforts from tech companies, some of our clients, really wanting to engage with policy conversations, policy debates. What do you see as the role of those tech companies or the value of those tech companies in your work? You know, and why, when do you want to engage with them, and when does it add value to your own reporting?
But I would say that the way that policy is made in Brussels is not only those people in an office, these bureaucrats, and then the parliament. I think industry is involved all along in the process. So of course we cannot report on tech policy without involving also the people that are going to be impacted directly by this policy. Like from day one, when a policy is think about, they have to go through this call for evidence that company have to fill. So for example, for me as a journalist, I'm looking at what the company are saying, because that's going to help shape the policy at the end.
I guess the other side of it then, Roman, you know, you have all of these tech companies really sort of like pushing a quite a positive, I assume, narrative of technology and what they're doing in the tech space. There's the other side. A lot of people are quite worried about AI and emerging tech. Some of those risks, challenges, worries are quite legitimate. Some, it might be suggested, they're a bit more over the top. Maybe that's a slightly wrong way of putting it. But I mean, how do you take some of those risks and challenges and worries and report on them without necessarily overstating some of the more speculative ones?
I would say that it's a lot about balancing when reporting, because I think it's important to have the aspect of what is the industry that wants and what are the concerns on the opposite from NGO or association. But when I report on this concern, it also needs to be based and backed up by proof, scientific proof. Explain to me, like, I need to see the logic. Like, I talk a lot with people that have concerns, for example, when there was the digital omnibus coming up, so this simplification rule from the Urban Commission, there was discussion that this could have repercussion on the data protection rules in the European Union, which is very dear to a lot of people. And so it was about discussing and understanding what are the actual concerns, how would this materialize, and if I deem that I can clearly see that this have consequences in people's life and is not an overstretch, and I would report on it. That is the way that I'm doing my job. If I relate to it, for me, it's interesting. After I actually put all my thinking and effort into understanding, then I would report on it.
I mean, you talked earlier about, you know, the need to drive clicks, and you know, every publication is a commercial entity these days. How far do you think kind of that need, and I'm not necessarily talking about you specifically here, you know, or Euronews, I'm talking about, you know, reporting across tech evolution and tech policy generally, but how often do you think that, you know, that need to publish a dramatic article or kind of get the clicks ends up actually exaggerating those risks and kind of, you know, driving the misconceptions around how policy is evolving?
I think that there is two powerful narrative at the end, that, and both of them are coexisting. One of them that technology is very dangerous in the way that we're going, and then with AI, all of this can lead to problem in our society, people losing their job, then the world's going to be taken over by AI. But also on the other end, I do believe that the narrative on the opposite, on business needs to have the place to thrive and to reduce their burden, and then this narrative is also quite present as well. So I would say that, yeah, both are coexisting, and I do not believe that there is more pressure from one or the other.
I mean, are there any particular kind of pieces of evolving policy that you think are really misunderstood at the moment, or you know, where that balance between the, you know, the threat and the opportunity is really, really interesting at the moment?
But I don't know if that's because it's the one that have been passed, but for the Digital Services Act, for example, that I found it a very interesting case of communicating a policy, and that is very badly understood, I would say. But at the end, the Digital Services Act of the DSA was approved almost 3 years ago to make what's illegal in real life illegal also online. And this also been, we talked a lot about this law when it comes to election. And because they have a requirement to having transparency of what content are being recommended to user, or explaining why some content are being pushed more than others in order to safeguard elections. And this have been taken as, oh, this is the EU trying to censor what is being said online. This is a propaganda machine. So I think that's one case where I believe it had been badly communicating, also because of there was this episode of this French commissioner that was Thierry Breton, that I've been saying that, what was it exactly, that they wanted to do to do for the German election like did for the Romanian election, meaning that they're going to monitor if there is any problem. But at the end, it was interpreted that, oh, just like the Romanian election have been cancelled, we're going to cancel the German election, which was not that way. But I hear it a lot in the US, that being said, when we had Marco Rubio coming to the mini conference, he was mentioning this. So, yeah, in the way that how a law is badly communicated.
Yeah, it sounds like it's almost like the policy itself maybe isn't misunderstood. It's just the communication around it has been really poor. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would say so. That is just, I mean, it's like the communication, but it goes end in end at the end. I would say that the piece of legislation is badly understood because it's badly communicated. But we also have this case, I don't know if you're interested, also in the AI Act, that I believe that the AI Act also is really badly understood, but this is less for me about the communication, but even the way that this is drafted, because the Act was made to reduce the risk on AI, which is very precise. But at the end, people that even been involved in the drafting of it been saying that they could not fully understand at the end what's inside because of the layer of what was added, that the companies that are supposed to comply to it are saying that they don't have precise standards to what it means, because they're like, oh, you need to have a high level of cyber protection. Well, what does that mean? It's like, what concretely do I do? So I think in that case, when the people that wrote the legislation do not understand it, and when the people that needs to comply cannot comply because it's not clear, I think it's logic that the general audience cannot fully comprehend this type of legislation.
I mean, that's a really good point. And I think that some of our clients might see that as an opportunity for them, right, to help provide some of that clarity that's lacking, you know, even from the people who wrote the legislation themselves. I mean, would you agree with that? I know you talked about, you know, the importance of hearing from the companies that the legislation's going to impact, but also just in terms of providing that clarity, kind of providing some illustrations around how this might affect. Do you work with comms teams on a regular basis that you go to help provide that extra sense of clarity?
Yeah, I would say that I'm in contact with communication team quite a lot. Like, for example, one topic that is quite big here in Brussels, but also in France, where I'm from, is the topic of age verification. So banning social media for teens or not. Then at the end, I think one of the people that are most interesting to talk to are the people that are going to be the one to implement this rule in place. And then they are the one telling us, well, we already have some safeguards and well, we are lacking some type of technology at the end to put this in place. So, yeah, I think it's important for me to go and ask them, because it's nice to have some great idea, but at the end, how do you apply it? It's often a before I would say of the commission in general.
Well, I wanted to dig in. We mentioned earlier, you know, some of the irrelevant messages you get from people who haven't bothered to check what you focus on. Give us some examples, kind of when you're working with comms teams at tech companies. What do you wish they did differently? Kind of what are the common things that they get wrong?
So as I said, not knowing what I want, or like pushing very, very pushy of like, you need to do this exactly, or you need to, yeah. Also, when I wrote something, asking me to read back what I did, or this type of practice that
to kind of change something you already published.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or that happened to me when I had a case with a big tech company, when I did an interview and then I had a quote, then I used an article and I was told the person did not say that when it was a recording. So that was for all the bad aspect, but also I think I'm having mostly great relationship with communication people from the organization I'm in contact with, talking about companies, but also, I don't know, institutions, that they are quite organized usually. And I feel like at the end, I'm getting a lot of help in my work from companies. So they can be providing expertise when there is a text coming up, or they can also provide what I think is very important for me when I write my story, is to incarnate the story and having some scientific backing. So for example, when there is a topic to communicate about, I think it's nice that somehow I can be provided with a survey or with just numbers to illustrate the point. Also what I saw, but it was more on the NGO side, but I found it still interesting, is having some human voice to illustrate, for example, oh, this is a testimonial from someone. And then I think that makes also a difference for, first of all, for me, when understanding what the story about, and then secondly, when I read.
Do you mean like, you know, like consumers, not necessarily, you know, policy experts at a tech company, but, you know, their customers or the people, the ultimate people whose daily lives are being impacted?
Like, for example,
and you find those voices through working with the tech companies and through working with comms teams as well?
Some of them, yes. For example, if you take the example of when I was saying the age verification for minor for social media, if some companies are saying that their system is correct and they want to show how nice they are, then they can have, for example, a testimonial of teenager being like, well, I was able to do this and this, this is what I can do now. So I think it illustrates at the end the point that the company is trying to make it more human also.
It's those real world stories, isn't it, that backs up some of the data that you get, and that makes a great package, doesn't it? You want a bit of data that shows the macro story, a human interest story that shows how it impacts people on the ground, so to speak, and then you can package that all up by almost then holding policymakers to account, because that's kind of your job, isn't it? It's to hold policymakers to account and also inform people about what's going on. And, you know, there must be a little bit of tension between those two roles, but those are the two core pillars of what you do at Euronews.
Yeah, I would say that I do a bit both, that I'm explaining on one side what's happening in Brussels, and I'm lucky that with Euronews we're in 15 languages, I think, in almost every EU country, and even beyond, that I think it's important that I'm here to explain with my understanding of the institution, with understanding of the tech environment, what are the complex laws that are being adopted here in Brussels, and what are the current discussion of where we are going right now with our tech policy. And like, for example, I found this example very revealing, that for example, you had this big headline that it was like the Council of the European Union agreed on the voluntary scanning of messages to find child sexual abuse material. That this sounds very complex and we don't understand what it's about. And I think my job here, for example, is to say that what that means, that social media will be scanning messages in order to find sexually implicit picture of children and to make sure that these are not being sent, but also saying that, oh, actually there is a risk for the privacy of every user online. So that's where my job is, to go beyond the, I think, effect of announce this and to see looking what's behind it and what it really means in human language and not simply commission consider. Yeah, but I think that that is one way to hold accountable. But the real way that I believe, like journalists, but it's less of my job. It's still being a journalist, but it's, I would say, another branch of my job that is investigative journalism and going further, saying, where, what are the big dynamics? What are some laws, for example, again, with like who is behind it and what are the motivation that I'm trying to do? But I don't always have the time for it. But we have great media here for that. So.
Yeah, and that's such a good point, isn't it? Like that's a classic role of a journalist, going behind a headline, doing those investigations. But you're, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here, but it feels like you're almost fighting to be quicker and faster than other media outlets, because you're fighting for those clicks, you're fighting against social media increasingly as well. How do you navigate that sort of tension between digging behind the headlines, holding that accountability, but also being the first, getting your story out there, breaking some news?
So usually, like, there is nothing I would say it didn't really happen that came out of the blue, and it is like a topic that was completely new to me. Because when there is a big announcement, they would say, I don't know, like a digital service act investigation going on, then I at least have the background of what the law is about and what this could mean for this company that is being investigated. So I think I already have some kind of background that's going to help me then to write faster. Also, there is something that we get as journalists that is called embargo documents, which is basically getting
and we know them well,
which is very useful. And it's not only from the commission or the institution or government or whatever. It also can come from companies that give in advance this document and be like, okay, you have until at this date at midnight, this is officially out, and then it's going to be out for everybody. But then in the meantime, you had time to write, to do your research. And so this is very helpful. And more in general, I think it was my editor that gave me this, this advice, that is always to do in a free step, to first doing right away what are the, and the announcement in very simple words. Then later on, it can be 1-2 days after, then having some reaction, having this is the broader, bigger story when you can go in detail. And then later on, what is the aftermath of it? So yeah, just instead of doing one article, a few for the same topic is also a way to go.
So if we're looking at, you know, again, the opportunities for communications professionals and comms teams to work with you, where in that process would that be most valuable? You know, perhaps you're talking about step two, where you're going a little bit deeper and you're kind of digging into the impact and the explainers. Where might you get most value from those sort of third party tech voices?
I would say all along. First of all, is for me, keeping a relationship with a journalist, like I find it useful that even if there is no news, just discussing with a calm person is going to say, okay, just letting you know, these are our worries, oh, this is going to come up, and then this is our vague position. And then knowing that at the moment when it comes, I can contact the person, or the person can contact me and then give me their opinion. So then it can be right at the announcement, if the person also managed to have like the text in advance and be like, okay, we know this, and being in contact and giving me this expertise and be like, oh, that like did happen. Someone be like, oh, have you seen this amendment? Have you seen this part? Just letting you know that this might be interesting. So, I mean, they're useful. And then of course, later on the broader analysis, having an opinion from the industry on reacting on the text that it proposes is always useful to understand like how relevant is that law and how possibly applicable once again is interesting.
Yeah. Do you have, Romain, do you have some like trusted contacts in each space? Are you always open to receiving new points of view, or is it very much a case of you've got a few voices who you like to go back to and chat to on a regular basis? As long as it's not about energy policy.
I can avoid it. I would say that it depends, and it's also like, I would say quite general when you make new friends. I mean, it's not friends, but you know, like there's some people that you know, then you're going to meet new people, then you forgot about them. And then in the future, oh, they move and then you see them again. It's a bit more like that, I would say. It's true that there is maybe some people that then I'm going to be more contacted than others. Then we're more in contact with them than others. However, I would say I'm still quite open in the way of receiving an email, as long as, I mean, it seems relevant to me to actually take the time to understand it and to report on it. But it's for sure that one is a relationship that is already being built, and then I know I can trust the person because in the past, the person always gave me interesting information. Then for sure, I'm going to be more open to... to report on what the person have to say to me, or to be able to respond, I would say.
Yeah, brilliant. Romain, we're on a podcast at the moment, and it will have escaped absolutely nobody that there is this rise of slightly non-traditional media outlets. I think it's fair to say that Euronews, they publish a lot of written articles, but I guess you're competing with, podcasts, newsletters are becoming huge as well. There's this rise of this independent, sort of very hyper-personalised form of journalism. Are you adapting the way that you report to compete with some of those other platforms?
First of all, Euronews mostly is a TV channel, like to begin with. Then we have our website with a news article, and we have newsletters, quite a few. So we're interested in one about EU policy in general, which I contribute on the tech site if you're interested in it. We also have a podcast. So to that, we are moving toward the transition. Also social media, we are on it, on YouTube, Instagram. I think on YouTube we are like something like 2.5 million subscribers with the content that we produce on TV, also our TV program, and on social media I believe that they are creating like they have explainers and also creating some kind of new concept and content. But it's a very interesting point that you point out, something about the personalization of the news, that I think at the end, I believe that it's also come from the TV, because we always have, like at Euronews, we have our main anchors. They are the face of the channel. And for me, it's not a new phenomenon to having one person incarnating the news. What I think is new is that right now there is a lot of opinion being spread. Because there is this phenomenon, I feel like, that people want to read news that go in their way. But I would say that's where us, in the way that we were reporting in Euronews, I think it was Massio said that we want to be like extremely neutral. So I think that's the way that we're trying to combat it, not towards going more in one side politically or the other, but trying to use neutral language. Because I feel like also now, the way that you're writing, the way that if you're presenting certain topics in a way, you can easily be categorized on one side or the other. And that's something that at Euronews you want to avoid.
Well, it compromises trust. Well, it might build trust with your key audience, but then on the other side, it compromises trust. So yeah, so you're... The antidote to too much opinion is fact and neutral.
Yeah, but still incarnate the news and having recognizable faces is still quite important, and the same for yeah. Trust and
So you're talking about, you know, the way Euronews is evolving and the way the media landscape is evolving. Are you also seeing from your work with comms teams from some of the companies you work with, are you seeing them change their policies and them change their tactics and the ways they interact with you? We're certainly seeing our clients wanting to consider more the impact of generative AI in terms of how people get their content, how people kind of learn information about them. Are you noticing any changes in the way the teams are interacting with you?
At the end, I've been working on topic for 2 years, so I don't know how much of an evolution I can
from there. Pretty quickly in the last 2 years.
Yeah, there could be some change, but I'm the generation that graduated with ChatGPT, so I think we are I was already entering into this world of communication and journalism with a very much innovative tech approach, if that makes sense.
And do you have any predictions or forecasts for how you think that might evolve over the next few years?
I would say that I think I'm a bit old school, and I think nothing is better than meeting yourself.
You're the ChatGPT generation. How can you be old school?
That's why. That's like, return value. It's like I'm fighting back from all this technology, and I think nothing is better than to meet someone around the coffee and building the within a relationship like this, having a face to put on a company logo, and to have a person that you can talk to and you can trust. Because as I say, like, there is so much, like, we're surrounded by information aggregating with ChatGPT. The entire day on my computer, I'm receiving a lot of emails, and I think at the end, cutting from it, just sitting down person to person, explain to me why what you do matters, I think it's the most empathic thing you can do. Because at the end, having relation skills and being able to talk good, I think that's something that AI could never replace you to. So at least not in person.
Yeah, I mean, no one wants to go for a cup of coffee with an AI, do they? Not yet, anyway. So I just picking up on what you were saying, I'm not really sure there's a question here, but I think, we're certainly seeing with the rise of generative AI, and that consumers and the public are going to generative AI to get their information about companies, about services, about policy. We're seeing that actually drive the need for really great PR, right? Because companies, their websites are not the destination anymore. So being talked about incredible publications like you guys is how people find out about the information they want. So I think we're certainly seeing some changes in terms of how clients want to be talked about, want to put information out about themselves. So hopefully that means, more interesting experts for you, kind of more well thought through communications around the policies that you're following.
So that's also a risk for media at the end, because we always talk about how social, comparing social media and mainstream media and how they are one against the other. But at the end, I do believe that it's media more against generative AI, that at the end, people, as you say, will not go on website, will not go on also news website, and we are losing a lot of traffic. And I think that's also, that can be the next big crisis for media.
Yeah, it's so interesting that we've dedicated a huge amount of time to this podcast talking about ChatGPT. And if you said that 2 years ago, people would have laughed. I mean, it was a fairly emerging technology even then. So to have it as this all pervasive technology now, not just in terms of tech policy and regulation, but also in terms of just how it impacts our lives, our jobs, what we do, it's fascinating. And Roman, maybe as a final question, I'm fascinated in your take on what we should be looking out for in the next 12 months. I mean, what is the big tech evolution or the new policy or regulation that you're interested in and that we should all be keeping an eye out for?
So I think as a bit usual, that a lot of it will be shaped by you know, the global geopolitical context. So with US, with China, because in Brussels we hear a lot of discussion how we want to be sovereign, independent, technology wise, how to boost our innovation, our technological capacities. There is something coming up about a strategy coming up on quantum technology. There is something also about AI, about cloud development. But there is also another discussion that is very pregnant here in Brussels, is about enforcing the rules that we have so far, because he said that the Commission is a bit scared to actually draw the line to big tech company, either American, because backed by Trump, or Chinese. So I think that's going to be a big discussion for 2026. And regarding policy wise, a topic that regarding pure policy, a topic that I've been following closely is regarding consumer protection. It's called the Digital Fairness Act, that I think is going to be quite interesting, because it's going to try to fill up the holes in the consumer protection laws that we have right now, and touching about what makes platform addictive and manipulative. So this could have a real impact on people's life, about the way they scroll and why do they stay there, and the way that they go online shopping, and why would they take a decision that they didn't want it to take at first. So I think that's going to be an interesting file to follow up. And maybe as a last one, something more generally, but it's not only in tech, but I mean all aspects of policy in general, but just is this simplification agenda that the Commission have been put forward since it's been elected 1 year and a half ago, about making all rules easier for companies, alleviate a bit the burden of compliance that they have so far, and all of it to boost economic growth. So I think that's some of the topic that for me, I know I will be keeping an eye on.
So what I'm hearing from that is tech policy is big, and the next 12 months are going to be very, very busy.
Yes, we will. I'm very lucky to be following this topic, because I think it's one of the most relevant one.
That was a really, really interesting conversation, Roman. I think, you know, so much to look forward to over the next 12 months. But all that's left to say, I think, is thank you very much for a fascinating conversation, Roman Amangor, EU tech policy reporter at Euronews.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Policy Matters, part of the Without Borders podcast series from Taito, the only PR and communications agency built to scale tech companies faster across Europe.